Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Steve Zwimke in for Lori Walsh this morning. Worldwide reports of UFOs have taken a sharp rise over the last few years, in particular the phenomenon of light clusters, orbs, or fireballs. What does this mean? And what can you do if you see something that you can't identify? Peter Davenport has been the director of the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington State since 1994. The center has a hotline and maintains a database of thousands of sightings that the public can browse on their website at nuforc.org. Mr. Davenport is also a weekly guest on Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie, where he provides a weekly update on UFO activity. He joins us today from Washington State. Peter Davenport, welcome to In the Moment.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm delighted to be here, and as I commented to you once before, this is only the second time I've been on a public broadcasting station, so in 22 years, so this is pretty exciting for me.
I find that amazing because I hear you on the radio and over the internet quite a bit. We're very glad to have you today. Let's start by giving a brief history about the National UFO Reporting Center. You've been there since 1994, but how long has the center been in existence?
Yeah, the UFO Center and its associated hotline were founded in October of 1974 by my predecessor in this job as director. His name was Robert J. Gribble. In 1974, he retired from the Seattle Fire Department. He had been very interested in UFOs for 2.5 decades, and he realized that what we needed in this country was one telephone number where anybody could call to report a sighting of a suspected UFO. He ran the center for 20 years and turned it over to me in 1994.
How was it that you got involved then?
Well, it was quite by accident, Steve. One Friday night, I was talking to a friend who knew both me and Bob Gribble, and he said, "Did you know, Peter, that Bob Gribble is considering shutting down the hotline?" The next call I made was to Bob to offer my assistance to help him keep it running, because I thought it was a tremendous asset to the UFO community. And before I knew it, Bob said, "Peter, it's yours." And many days I wish I had never accepted his generous offer of taking over the hotline, because it's re-engineered my view of what reality is or may be.
I bet. I had a chance to browse the website. Again, that's nuforc.org. And it's interesting because you can go in there and look state by state at reports throughout several years dating way back. And, of course, my interest was in South Dakota reports, and there's not a lot there for South Dakota. One of the more interesting reports from our state's history, though, goes back into the 60s and out in the Ellsworth Air Force Base area. And I know reports that of activity near missile silos were popular back when a lot of our silos were in existence. But we had those reports back in the 60s.
Yeah, I'm familiar with some of those reports. I'm not sure I'm familiar with the exact case you have in mind, but there have been a lot of incidents involving missile sites with nuclear-tipped missiles in them and UFOs. In fact, there's a small group of UFO investigators who specialize in those cases. One who comes to mind in particular is Robert Hastings, who's written a very nice book on the subject entitled UFOs and Nukes. I have a copy of it. I read it, pick it up and read it, and it's a fascinating read to think that these creatures who we believe come here can manipulate our technology to the degree that appears to be the case.
Yeah, because we don't have really any infamous reports here from South Dakota, we should visit about a couple of these that have really caught the public's eye over years. And Travis Walton's case is, of course, one. A movie was made about that. And why don't you go into detail a little bit for us with the Travis Walton case?
A very interesting case. I agree with you, Steve. It was November 5th, 1975. A group of young men were out in a forest in southwestern Arizona near Snowflake, Arizona. and they had finished their work. They'd put all their tools in the back of a crew cab pickup truck, an International Harvester, I happen to remember, and they were bouncing down a logging road, and they saw a glow of red light up ahead of them. It concerned them because they thought they were driving towards a forest fire. Turned out not to be a forest fire. It was a disc hovering over a cleared area in the forest. And Travis Walton, being the type of person he was, got out of the truck and started walking towards it. Well, the witnesses recounted later that the disc spat out a bolt of white light that hit him in the chest and the head and the upper chest. And they did what good buddies do whenever they see one of their members shot by a bolt of light out of a UFO, started the truck and started bouncing down the down the mountainside to get away from all of this. They came back shortly thereafter, but they couldn't find Travis, who was gone for about 5 days. And the movie and the book that you alluded to address very nicely, well, not the movie so much, but his book addresses very nicely the details of his absence. It was a remarkable case.
And Travis Walton was claiming abduction, right?
Yeah, when he finally woke up, he apparently was rendered unconscious or, interestingly, perhaps even dead. We don't know which. The next conscious recollection he has is waking up lying on a pedestal or a gurney in a disc with three strange creatures standing around him in red uniforms, and that's where it starts getting very interesting. Yeah. He was, of course, mortified at where he was, didn't have any idea where he was, whether he remembered the disc that he had been walking towards or not, I don't know at this point, but he was able to wander around the craft that he apparently was on. Interestingly, at one point, he sat in a seat that faced the wall. When he sat in it, the wall turned transparent so he could see stars in the night sky very clearly. And there was a recessed ball in the arm of this chair he was sitting in, and he moved that ball in the recess, and when he moved the ball to the right, all the stars tipped to the left, and vice versa. So he apparently was in some kind of control room, or was in a position to be able to control at least the orientation of that craft that he was now captive on. Later on, they went to a larger ship, and he describes how he saw a bay full of similar disks in rows and columns. It's a fascinating case. The title of the book and the movie are identical. It's Fire in the Sky, and I recommend the book over the movie.
Yeah. This obviously had to be a difficult case for not only Travis to talk about, but his friends as well who were with him. And obviously, you know, there are a lot of people that are going to look at Travis Walton's case and just, you know, call it a bunch of bunk. What's life been like for Travis Walton since then, having, you know, gone through probably tons of skepticism? What's life been like for him?
Yeah, well, fortunately, Travis is a very intelligent and, moreover, stoical person. He's a stoic by nature, I believe. That's my interpretation. He's a delightful guy, and I feel privileged to be able to call him a close friend in the field of ufology. But his story, to my eye and to my ear, has not changed one whit in the whole time since that incident occurred. And he's just the type of person you believe. He's very circumspect in his personal life, it would appear, and he's just a delightful guy. My strong impression is that everything occurred as he recounts it to the public.
Peter Davenport from the National UFO Reporting Center in Washington State is our guest. He directs the center. Peter, we just had an anniversary here of the infamous Phoenix Lights case.
Yes.
Was that satisfactorily explained by the military, or are you still suspicious of that event?
Well, not by the military and not by the U.S. government and certainly not by the press, but it was, I believe, satisfactorily investigated by UFO investigators. And I'll never forget the night that my phone started ringing. It was a Thursday night, March 13th, 1997. You're right, it's a 20-year anniversary. Hard to believe. Seems like yesterday to me. But we collected an immense amount of data. I think all told, about 1,500 reports were collected by all investigators. And it was a very dramatic case. And we have solid reason to believe that the case induced the U.S. military to declare a Defense Condition 3. They went directly from DEFCON 5, which is the lowest state of preparedness, mm-hmm. to DEFCON 3, skipping 4 altogether. And a curious aspect of all of this, Steve, is the fact that when all of this was occurring in Phoenix is exactly the time that President Clinton, who had been golfing down in Florida with the Australian golfer Greg Norman, injured his knee. And one of the things I incorporate in most of my lectures is the possibility that a president of the United States was injured as an indirect result of what I consider to have been the most dramatic UFO sighting in all of UFO history. If they declared a Defense Condition 3, I presume somebody would have had the presence of mind to pick up a telephone and let the commander-in-chief know about all of this. And it is intriguing to consider the possibility that he may have been injured while he was being moved to a vehicle, for example, or raced down a staircase to get to a vehicle. It's intriguing to consider that a president of the United States might have been injured by a UFO incident, albeit indirectly injured.
And when we look at the Phoenix Lights case, it's a case where many, I mean hundreds, possibly thousands of people were witnesses. That's not often the case when you get a report, is it?
No, you're exactly correct. It's usually one or at most a very small number of people who see or who at least report their sighting. Most people don't report their sightings. In fact, my estimate is that out of somewhere between 10,000 and 20,000 Americans who see what they sincerely believe was a UFO, only one of them will ever report it in a meaningful fashion. Meaningful meaning that they write it down and they capture all the details in written form and report it to an organization like the National UFO Reporting Center. But
Why is that? Is there some trepidation? Is that probably the number one factor?
If I were to write a book, it would not be about UFOs, Steve. It would be about the human psychology I've been witness to during the course of my investigating the UFO phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
People do the strangest things, at least from my vantage point, strange, related to sightings of UFOs. But that's a question I ruminate on every day of the week, is why do so few people report UFO sightings when, in fact, we know that there are many, many more sightings than come in on a real-time basis. And I say that because we continue to get sighting reports from past decades. So we know that there have been many, many more sightings than we have reports for.
Yeah. But tell me about situations where possibly law enforcement or the government have clammed up after a story has come out and has possibly even been in the media, and then all of a sudden people stop talking. I'm familiar with the Todd Cease case from, I believe, out in Pennsylvania.
Oh, yeah.
And that is certainly an example of that.
Yeah, the Phoenix Lights was an example of that, too. The governor of the state of Arizona, Fife Symington,
mm-hmm.
10 years after the Phoenix Lights incident in 2007, admitted that he had seen one of the craft but didn't talk about it. And Leslie Kane, a very skilled journalist and author, has documented that very carefully and to my satisfaction. But the Todd Sees case is another dramatic case, in this case a tragic one, because Mr. Sees was reported having been taken up into a saucer, into a metallic-looking saucer-shaped craft that was sitting above Mount Montour in Pennsylvania. This was back in 2004, I believe. And a manhunt was mounted, and they had about 250 people searching for him. They didn't find him until about 40 hours after his apparent abduction. And tragically, not only was he dead, but his remains reportedly were grossly mutilated, so mutilated that the coroner did not allow the family to view the remains at any time after he was discovered. And his remains were found suspended in a tree or heavy underbrush, tragically found by his son, who, it is reported by one of the family members, didn't even recognize that it was his late father, the remains of his late father. But tragic case. It wasn't investigated until 10 years later, tragically. I tried my level best to get anybody interested to go out and actually investigate the case. But you're right, it was a very dramatic incident.
And that was on his property, is that correct?
Yes, he had left his home at 5 a.m. that morning. It was on a Sunday morning, I believe, to drive up to his family property a few miles away on the top of Mount Montour. He was going up there to scout out populations of deer in preparation for the Pennsylvania deer season. And that was the last that anybody saw of Mr. Sees alive. And you're right, the police would not talk to me. In fact, it is recorded that they threatened a UFO investigator with arrest if he persisted. Of course, they had no authority in that matter. I talked to the coroner, James Kelly, newly elected coroner back then in 2004, and he spoke to me, but only for about 1 or 2 minutes, and then he said that he was very uncomfortable being on the telephone with me, and he would have to bring that conversation to a close. So clearly, and the FBI was involved in it. Why the FBI was brought into the case was never explained satisfactorily, and they didn't even return my phone call. That's very curious for the FBI.
You've never had that happen before either, right?
No, never.
Peter, we are getting close to running out of time. We still have a couple of minutes left. I want to move on to the phenomenon here. We talked about reports sharply on the rise over the last few years, but one of the things that's causing that rise are the reports of luminous objects, not necessarily like a disc or cigar-shaped object or something
right.
like that. More
yeah.
like fireballs or orbs or just these clusters of lights. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I can say with pretty good certainty that the phenomenon began during late May of 2012, and we still don't understand it, and all UFO organizations agree that it is the phenomenon of ufology in today's world. People are seeing clusters of anywhere from 2 to 200 fireballs or orbs. That's what we call them. They're traditionally red, orange, yellow, amber, or gold. And to give our audience some idea of the gravity of the situation, I estimate that the National UFO Reporting Center has collected or received not fewer than 20,000 such reports over the last almost 5 years now. I talked to other investigators frequently about this phenomenon, and they're scratching their head just as I am over this incident. For our listeners who would like to see some interesting reports, one of them from a former U.S. astronaut, they can go to our database and look at cases for the 5th of July 2013, Athens, Texas. This astronaut I alluded to had six of them go right over his head. The same year, September 28th, in Glendale, Arizona, a retired Arizona Highway Patrol officer saw, he estimates, upwards of 200 of them. Very interesting phenomenon indeed.
Yeah. And, you know, you get into, you know, you're talking about people of credibility, people that are universally respected. When you talk about an astronaut or somebody that's in law enforcement, it really makes a person pause and think about what they're saying. You were telling me yesterday about an incident, too, down in Louisiana or just off the coast of Louisiana. Do you have any more details on that?
Unfortunately, I have no more details than what are contained in the report we've posted. This occurred March 21st, just last week. A gentleman who describes himself as a chief engineer aboard a supply vessel that takes supplies out to the oil derricks alleges that a huge disc, he estimated 1,200 feet in diameter, rose out of the ocean and zipped off. We're having a very difficult time getting the witness, other witnesses, to come forward and submit reports, and I don't know why that is. I just received an email from another mariner yesterday apprising me that all these vessels have video cameras rolling 24 hours a day, so there may be good video, but it's not being made available to us.
Sounds like everybody's gone silent again.
It has. It does indeed, Steve.
Peter, we are out of time, but before we go, please share the hotline number for the National UFO Reporting Center for our listeners that might like to get in touch with you about something they may have seen.
You bet. We've had this number for the last 43 years. It's area code 206 for Seattle, 722-3000, 206-722-3000. And the website address we like to use is just ufocenter.com. Nine letters, one word, ufocenter.com.
Got it. Peter Davenport, Director of the National UFO Reporting Center, thank you so much for sharing some time with us, and hopefully we can sit down again sometime.
That would be wonderful. Thank you, Steve.